and it was probably the uncoolest bar, not just in Manchester, possibly in the world, but, you know, it was our lesbian bar.
Hello, I'm Kay Anderson, and you are listening to Lost Spaces, the podcast that mourns the death of queer nightlife. Every episode, I talk to a different person about a venue from their past, the memories that they created there, and the people that they used to know. So, out of all of the musicals that I think you could possibly blame for making you gay, I would have guessed that Les Miserables, it's fun to say, would be somewhere near the bottom of the list. But not, it turns out, if you are radio presenter, author, and host of the Coming Out Stories podcast, Emma Goswell, who had her queer awakening with thanks to that historical story about a French peasant and his quest for redemption in 19th century France. Yeah, I can see how that works. We caught up to talk about Manchester in the 90s, and in particular, the lesbian bar Follies, which sounds like one of those delightfully bizarre places that has a little bit of everything for everybody, including those who just want to sit down and have a nice cup of tea. Now, before we get into it, just a little bit of context setting. We start off the conversation by discussing the strange rivalry that is in place in England between the North and the South. And I'm pretty sure that every country has their own version of this, so there's probably not too much that I need to tell you. But the long and short of it is, in the North, people are seen as friendly and open and homely and giving. And in the South, they're just a bunch of bitches, pretty much. That's a total oversimplification, but that's enough to get us going. So why don't we hop on into it? Let's start off on a very non-contentious, non-controversial subject. I hope you can tell I'm being sarcastic when I say that. What would you say are the main differences between Northerners and Southerners?
Northerners are more friendly.
That's it.
That is the main difference. And by the way, I say this as a Southerner.
I don't know if you can tell
my accent. I was actually born in Guildford, south of London. So spent a lot of time in London in my youth. But then moved to Liverpool in 1990 for university. And I would say the main difference is that people will talk to you. I once made the mistake of trying to talk to people on the tube and they will not talk to you. They will just think you're insane and probably out to murder their children and have nothing to do with you. Whereas everybody wants to be your friend. If you're waiting for the bus or on a tram in Manchester, people will have a good bit of chinwag with you.
So in defence of London, as someone who lives in London, and I might have Stockholm syndrome, totally appreciate that, so call me on my BS. But, like, I think people are, like, friendly enough. Sometimes when I go north, I'm like, you don't need to know this about me. You should piss off.
No, but that's great, I think, when you're waiting for a bus and you find out about some old lady's hernia, or, you know, you hear their life story. It's fascinating.
Well, what if you've got, like, an interesting book to read or something? I don't know. Okay. Well, so that's the main difference then, you say?
I'd say so, yeah. Things are cheaper, life's a bit nicer, and, yeah. Houses are cheaper, people are friendlier. Move up north, Kay, basically, is what I'm saying.
And did you... is that the reason you're there?
Well, no, I just moved here because I got accepted to three universities. One was in London, London College of Printing. One was in Canterbury, and I could have gone to study film. Could be a film director by now. And the other was Liverpool Polytechnic. That's how old I am. There were polytechnics when I applied to go to uni. And I just chose Liverpool, actually, because really I thought London, I've been there, done that, and I can't really afford it. And if you're a student, it's, you know, probably quite desperate and quite difficult to be a student in London. Canterbury I didn't go to because I felt like it was a very small place and I actually thought everybody will know my business. And I actually didn't want, and this sounds ridiculous saying this now, I didn't want everyone to be talking about me because I was the gay I actually went to university under the ridiculous misapprehension that life would be easier if I was just straight, so I was just going to deny that part of my life and just blend in and be straight. So
wait, so let me make sure I understand what you've just said. So you were going to present as straight or you were going to be straight?
Well, both, yeah. But let me just tell you, it didn't last very long. It lasted a day, and then I drank a bottle of vodka, threw up in my neighbour's front garden and told everyone I was a lesbian. So it didn't last very long, but that was my thinking. My thinking was, I won't go to Canterbury because everyone will know my business because it's very small and everyone will know me. Whereas I thought, I'll go to a big city, new beginning, new start, loads of different opportunities. And yeah, for some reason, I got it into my head that I was going to be straight.
And when you say tell everyone?
Well, just my neighbours and everyone in my house. It was a student campus, so it was my neighbours and everyone in my house. I told everyone that I was a lesbian on about day one, yeah.
Okay. And so is that generally your approach to keeping secrets?
Yeah, pretty much. I don't think my modus operandi's changed at all since then. I'd be the world's worst spy, Kay. I really would. I'd just blab at... Give me a couple of vodkas and I'll just blab everything.
Oh, fantastic. This is useful information for a later date.
Yeah.
So prior to going to university then, had you had any experience of being out?
No, I'd had experience of falling in love with a woman and having a relationship. Then that was at school, but I'd kept that very much under wraps. Uh-huh. And I thought for about the next 30 years that no one knew, and then it turns out that everyone knew.
Ah, that you two were hooking up.
Yeah. And there was me just being really insecure and internalised homophobia and not out at all, thinking that my secret was safe and no one knew. No, I didn't tell anyone. I told my best friend at school on the day we left school. I made sure we left because I just thought my life would just be over if I had to come out at school.
Yeah.
So I came out the day we left, yeah.
I am learning a lot from you about this, actually. Like, so you kept it until that very last day, and then you were like, I can't hold it in anymore, out it comes. And then a similar thing happened when you went to university.
Yeah, and then I just blurted it all out after far too much to drink. Well, it's very damaging and difficult being in the closet, isn't it, really? You know, and I'd only done a few months, really.
And it's so much more exhausting than you think... Or that you can even really fathom.
Yeah, no, it is. It's really exhausting. And I'd only done, because I realised I was gay on January the 26th, 1989. So I only did from then to when we broke up in June. So I only did January, February,
that's
March,
quite good.
About 5 months.
I hope I'm not sounding too patronising here, but that's good. It's like... So are we allowed to talk about January the 26th, 1989?
Yeah, go for it.
So up until then, were you just, like, oblivious to your sexuality, or...?
Yeah, I was pretty clueless, really. I was very aware that all my friends for several years had been not just dating men but sleeping with men. Well, boys, really. They were very promiscuous. They wanted to go and they wanted to have sex and they talk about it a lot. And I felt that I wasn't ready and I... It hadn't really dawned on me, but the fact that I wasn't ready was because I didn't fancy the boys and I didn't really care that I didn't have a boyfriend at school.
But you were in this mindset that, like, at some point a switch is going to flick and it's going to make sense.
Yeah, and at some point I'm going to fancy boys and I'm going to be ready for it. And I remember feeling really sort of left out and thinking, oh, everyone's going to think I'm a really square or really... It's pathetic, isn't it, that the things that you think when you're young and impressionable... You know, I thought my friends wouldn't want to be my friends because I didn't have anything in common with them because they were all talking about the boys and going off and having boyfriends and dates and doing what teenage girls do.
Some teenage girls. Let's not generalise. Sorry.
No, that's true. That's true. Well, not me. No, not me. But my friends didn't particularly care, really. They just loved me for me and, you know, we still had a good friendship. But, yeah, I just didn't click. I didn't click that the fact that I wasn't hooking up with boys or interested was because I was gay until the moment I fell in love with a woman.
And then January 26th rolled around. Let's paint the scene. What were you wearing?
I can't remember that level of detail, Kay. I don't know how good you think my memory is.
Okay, I don't need that much detail. Tell me what happened on that day.
I'm at school. Mm-hmm. I'm at a boarding school in the home counties. We go on a school trip to go and see Les Miserables, which is basically what made me gay.
Okay, good to know.
Watched that. It was all very enlightening. Had a wonderful night out at the theatre. We get the coach back to school and I start chatting to this girl who I'd never really talked to before because she was in the year below, but she'd only just joined in the sixth form. So I was in the upper sixth, she was in the lower sixth. Started chatting to her on the coach on the way back. And I just couldn't process my feelings. I was just like, you know when you start talking to someone and you just connect with them so well. And the more and more you start talking, the more and more you want to know about them and the more you want to impress them. And then the more I started talking, the more I was thinking, God, this person's amazing. This person is what incredible. Oh, my God, I really want to touch this person. And then I was like, what is going on in my brain?
And where do you want to touch this person, Emma? Where?
Yeah. Yeah, so then I did. Yeah, things happened that very night, actually. Then I woke up the next day on January the 27th thinking that my life was over. I mean, I literally thought I was the world's worst pervert. There was something wrong with me. It was definitely a secret that I'd never be able to tell. But I was besotted. I was absolutely in love with this girl.
Okay, so I'm going to ask for personal details here because I'm nosy. That evening of the 26th, who was the one that made the first move?
Oh, definitely me, I would say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I felt terrified, but yeah.
So you went from unsure to the aggressor in, like, the span of a few hours.
I know, exactly. Like, didn't even know to predatory lesbian in just literally a few hours, yeah. Oh, awful.
There's one born every minute, I hear.
Yeah. Yeah, it is mad looking back on it, but yeah, that's how it worked, yeah. And I wasn't even really drink involved because it was a school trip.
You were drunk on theatre, maybe? No.
That's what it was. I don't say. Les Miserables made me gay.
Okay, and so then the next day, like, I'm going to make the assumption, you don't need to go into details, that what you got up to wasn't really very extreme.
No, it was fairly tame. Yeah.
But the next day, regardless, you woke up and you were just like, uh-oh, we've screwed everything up.
Oh, I felt sick. I couldn't eat.
Really?
I felt sick to my stomach. I really did. I just felt like, you know, my life was over. Well, my life, in a certain sense, was over, you know. My life of convincing myself that I was straight was definitely over.
Oh, I've just actually made the connection that you were at boarding school. Did you, like, sleep in the same bed or did you sneak off?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had my own room because I was sixth form. And by the way, please don't make the assumption that it was an all-girls school, which many people do, because it wasn't. There were boys at our school, but I was definitely not interested in them.
So there was even more evidence that you weren't really that interested because they were around you all the time.
They were around, yeah, exactly. We didn't have to go and hook up with different schools in, like, lunch hour or whatever. No, there were boys all around us and didn't particularly like them. Not in that way.
So what happened after that then? You spent a day beating yourself up, or maybe more than a day?
Yeah, well, you know, and I wasn't even sure what we were doing or whether she was interested. We had a discussion and we realised that we wanted to carry on and have some sort of relationship. So we did. We had a very clandestine affair for the last few months that I was at school and kept it going and until we left school. Yeah. And it was very, very exciting and very, yeah, erotic. And I felt like I was doing something naughty that made it even more exciting in a way.
That's the thing, isn't it? It's really annoying that it's kind of actually fun keeping a secret sometimes.
Yeah, but it was exciting, but it was weird, and because I just felt like I was doing something wrong and that there was something wrong with me and I had all these negative connotations, because bear in mind, this is the 1980s and there were no LGBT role models to speak of. There was a couple of gay pop stars who were men who were very much in the scene, but you know, there were no lesbian role models. I didn't have anyone to look up to or aspire to or want to be. It was, you know, I literally thought I was the only lesbian in the world.
I don't want to sound really ignorant when I say this. Did you have the vocabulary?
Oh, did I know the word lesbian?
Yeah, like, did you understand that as a concept?
Yes, I think so. It's hard to remember that far back now. Yeah, no, I think I did. I don't think it was a word I liked, and I didn't want to use that word for a very, very long time.
Ooh.
It was, you know, there's definitely a lot of lesbophobia out there, isn't there? And I think there's something about that word that, you know, certainly I rejected for a long time, and I would always come out and say, I'm a gay woman. I would never say, I'm a lesbian. It took me a while to sort of accept it. And I've spoken to plenty of other women who've had the same experience, really. I think there was just so many derogatory connotations with lesbians and lesbianism. I don't know why.
And how do you feel about that word now?
Well, now I can handle it, and I'm now much happier with it. But, yeah, it's shameful, really, just how much shame that I felt. And I didn't want to associate with the word.
What about the word dyke? Sorry, I'm taking us off on a...
Yeah, that I think is probably even worse. I don't know. Oh, I definitely okay. wouldn't... If someone had called me that, I think I would have definitely just assumed that that was an insult. Mm-hmm. So it sounds quite an aggressive, derogatory 80s term. And I know plenty of people who've reclaimed it, and, you know, that's fine if you're happy with that. I'm all for reclaiming language, but for me, it wasn't acceptable. I would not want it to be called a dyke.
Mm. There's something about the way the word lesbian feels inside your mouth. Like, even when you just, like, don't have it attached to other meaning, like, the actual yeah. meaning, there's something yeah. about it that just feels very old-fashioned. It's just it's not yeah. as much fun to say as other words.
Yeah. Yeah, it does sound old-fashioned.
But is that just my internal lesbophobia?
Probably.
Yeah, it's really hard to know. Okay. Okay, so, but... You went from this being in this relationship, right, and then it ended at the end of your school term.
Well, no, we finished school in June, and then she finished with me in October. So it lasted nine months.
Oh, but you went to university when?
Oh, then I took a year out and went travelling.
Ah, okay, okay. Because I was thinking if the timeline meant that you went to school in September, but you were telling everyone you were straight for about 12 hours, then that didn't add up. But you went away for a year. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I went travelling. Went around Asia and Australia and then came back and then went to university.
Ah.
So even though I'd had a year of the odd fling and the odd dalliance, I still decided, oh, it'd just be easier. It's just hard work being gay. It was just me being very lazy as well, I think, as well as full of shame.
Yeah. And when you say lazy, like having to have that conversation multiple times with new people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is exhausting being gay, isn't it? You don't have to have that conversation all the time. You could literally have it every day. You really could. I had an occasion yesterday where I had someone ring up about some medical procedures I have to have, and I said, oh, my partner will come and pick you up, and they said, oh, yeah, well, we'll get the nurses to tell him when's a good time. And I just thought, I can't even be bothered. I can't even be bothered to correct the pronouns of who you think my partner is. I just can't be bothered. But sometimes I do. Sometimes I make a point of it.
Yeah, yeah. They're tough. I think, like, I don't really have a battle with that because everyone just assumes I'm gay as soon as they meet me. So I don't ever have that situation. But it is that thing of, you know, when you're correcting someone, you're telling them they're wrong and then they feel shame and then it all becomes this weird thing because, you know, it's exhausting to then potentially deal with them responding to the shame that they feel for getting it wrong and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. So totally there's a lot to think about, isn't there? And I just, you know, I hadn't really met this woman. It was just a telephone conversation. I just thought, oh, you seem like a lovely person. I'm not going to challenge your heteronormative assumptions on this occasion.
Yeah. Okay, so we were talking about university, we were talking about coming out, we were talking about getting dumped by your first love.
Mm. Mm.
But what we weren't talking about is how you ended up in Manchester.
Oh, yeah. Well, I did a degree in media studies, which is pretty useless. There weren't masses of jobs available to me, funnily enough. And certainly in Liverpool, in the early 1990s, graduating with a degree in media studies, there were not loads of opportunities for me there. So really, I should have gone to London for career opportunities, but I just couldn't face it. So I thought, well, I'm just going to go to the next big city, the next best place, really. So I just moved to Manchester with my girlfriend at the time. Didn't know a soul. Best decision ever made. Absolutely love the city and feel a real part of it now and genuinely feel like an honorary Mancunian because I've been here since 1996, so quite a while now,
So, let's play a word game.
Oh, gosh, okay. It's very deep.
It's not deep. Cast your mind back to that time.
Mm-hmm.
You've just rocked up in Manchester. You're brand new to the city. What are the three words to describe how you feel?
Well, nervous and excited, definitely the first two, I would say. And what's a word that would sum up being full of anticipation?
Oh, anticipatory? No.
Yeah, I think that is a word.
Doesn't mean you're... Yeah, okay. Full of anticipation for what?
For all the adventures that would lie ahead. Like, I did feel like Manchester was a lot more of an exciting place to be, especially for someone in the LGBTQ plus community, because I used to spend a lot of time in Liverpool getting minibuses and coaches over to Manchester because the gay scene was so much bigger in Manchester. Mm-hmm. So I felt like a kid in a sweetie shop. Was like, God, there's just so many gay people here and so many opportunities and so much more going on than Liverpool, which is a relatively small city centre. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was genuinely excited to move there and think about, you know, starting my career and just going out and making my mark in the world, really.
Mm-hmm. And so where does Follies come into this?
Yeah, so I don't know why this place is the first place that came into my head, because it is like something out of old-fashioned lesbian folklore, really, and I could have picked somewhere genuinely cool that I was going out, like the Hacienda. But when I moved to Manchester, what was a bit more of a regular night, because Flesh was only once a month, but I can't remember even if this bar was full-time or if it was just a Saturday night, but we'd always go on a Saturday night, and Follies was just somewhere where the lesbians would go. It was a women-only space, and that was where I was drawn to. And it was probably the uncoolest bar, not just in Manchester, possibly in the world, but, you know, ooh, it was our lesbian bar.
Is that, like, so uncool that it's cool?
Oh, God, I hope the people that ran this never hear this interview.
So unpack this statement for me. Old-fashioned lesbian folklore.
Yeah. I think I'd heard about this place from years before, and I think it was somewhere that the older lesbians would go, mm-hmm. because there was a bit at the back where there was a dance floor, but there was also plenty of space at the front where you could just sit down and have a conversation, which is what I'd probably want to do if I went to a bar or a club now. It did have a bit of an older feel about it. It wasn't a young, trendy place. Mm-hmm. It was your older, more sensible, established lesbians who would go. I think that's how I remember it anyway. I mean, my memory is fucked, so this may be the most inaccurate testimony that Follies have ever had in their lives, really, but that's how I remember it.
It wasn't a lesbian bar, it was an Irish bar. No, so you've just said that your memory's fucked, so there's probably no point in me asking this question, but do you remember the very first time you ever went there?
Probably not, no. But I do remember my first impressions, yeah. And I think the main thing that surprised me was, and I still tell people this because I just still couldn't quite believe it, that they had a framed picture of Martina Navratilova behind the bar. I was just like, honestly, I went to this bar and there was a framed picture of Martina behind the bar.
Do we need to explain who Martina is in case there's anyone out there who doesn't recognise that she is a lesbian icon?
Yeah, she's a lesbian icon. Sadly, not an icon of mine particularly anymore because of all the anti-trans statements that she's come out with more recently. So let's draw a veil over that. But certainly at the time, incredibly famous for winning more Wimbledons than any other woman and just winning more tennis tournaments. But not only that, she was out and proud and gay. And I remember watching Wimbledon with my mother and wondering why she had a little pink triangle on her racket, and then looking it up and realising, you know, this was a queer statement in the 80s on a massive, massive platform that is, you know, this is what I said, in the 80s there were no lesbian role models. She was the only one that anyone could ever name and go, there's a gay woman. Mm-hmm. So for that reason, the people that ran the bar were obviously big fans and framed a picture of her and put her behind the bar.
And that's one of your lasting memories from being in that space.
My lasting memory, yeah. And also I do remember some of the bar staff being incredibly unfriendly and grumpy. And this might be, I mean, I really hope they don't listen to this interview. Maybe it was just me they took a disliking to. But I do remember, it had an odd atmosphere. I always had the best time when I went. But thinking about it, there was always a bit of an odd atmosphere. And they also always have, what do you call it? A hatch, that's the word. They had a hatch into the kitchens and you could order food and cups of tea. So that's what I mean, it was a bit of an odd nightclub because, you know, there would be people in the back where the actual disco was and where the music was, but then there'd be people at the front drinking cups of tea.
And having a toasted cheese sandwich.
Yeah, and having a toasted cheese sandwich, yeah. And that it's very basic sort of food, but yeah, there'd always be people ordering food from the hatch and sitting at the front, and it was like a sort of tea tea cafe at the front.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
Yeah, you're liking the idea of this, aren't you?
I love the idea of that. Like, the dance floor's a bit too much for me now. I'm going to go and have a break, fill up on carbs, get ready to go back.
What I'm going to do is have a nice cup of tea. I've never been to a nightclub where people are sitting having cups of tea, but people did in Follies. It was bizarre.
Well, not to harp on about stereotypes about Northerners, but, I mean, it makes sense to my fantasy.
Yeah, having cups of tea.
Okay, so why were they horrible to you?
Probably because I was an annoying, obnoxious young person and they were, you know, a bit older. Maybe they didn't want young... Well, I'm not going to use the word trendy because I've never been trendy in my life, but maybe they didn't want younger types in that. I don't know. It's probably just a couple of times, but these things stick in your memory, don't they? If people are unfriendly to you or just a bit rude, then it will stick in your mind, really.
Yeah. But can you help me understand? Yeah. So you said that this was, you just remember that this was the place that you went every Saturday, but you also remember it being like for an older clientele and not necessarily targeted to your friend group.
Yeah.
Why did you go every week?
But I think it was a mix. So I think there was a mix. Oh, okay. So there was definitely, I would go with my girlfriend at the time or I'd go with friends and there were definitely younger people. So there was a real mixture there actually. So it was, because there weren't many different places where women could hang out and just wanted to be with other women. You know, we don't have loads of lesbian bars in any city in the world, you know. Women-only spaces and lesbian bars are fairly few and far between, really. So when you get one and it's regular, you will go and support it and you will hang out with other women.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. What's your preference in terms of spaces? Do you prefer mixed, women-only, a third thing?
Mixed, definitely.
Ah, okay.
I think I was attracted to go to Follies because I wanted to meet other women. That was what me in my 90s youth was all about. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to meet other women. I wanted to go out and I wanted to go on the pool. That was why I went to Women Only Spaces. It was purely to meet other potential girlfriends, shall we say.
Well, let's talk a bit more about this then. First of all, to cue me in, your flirt game, scale of 1 to 10, how good are you? 10 being good.
On a scale of 1 to 10? Oh, my God, I don't know. I've always been confident and I've always been chatty. So, yeah, I'd say a strong 8.
Ooh.
I'd say an 8, yeah.
Ooh. You're betting on yourself here, Emma.
Well, I don't think I would do... I wouldn't do any cheesy chat-up lines. I've just always got stuff I want to talk about, so I'd always find an opening and something to chat about.
Oh, OK. So that's your approach, just free, open, easy.
Yeah, no chat-up lines, just start talking.
But once you've started talking, you need them to know that you're interested.
Mm.
So what do you do?
Oh, I don't know. What do I suppose it's more in the look, isn't it, than the words.
Oh, okay, so it's not like touching elbows and like leaning in a bit closer.
Oh, is that what you do?
No, I don't know what I do. I think I'm just a bit like, do you fancy me? Do you want to snog? I'm like, I'm not really that interested in the subtlety.
And it's all about permission, isn't it? So I did ask someone once, would you like it if I kissed you? And they said yes, so then I knew I was on to a winner.
Aww. But you only did that once.
I only did that once. It's a good line, though, isn't it?
Well, there are people that sit in different camps. Like, I think it's nice to be like, I am going to do this. Are you okay with that? But there are some people who kind of find that a bit insulting, like, you should just take the initiative. But maybe they're just seeped in the patriarchy.
Disgust. That's like an essay title, doesn't it? Yeah,
I don't know. Okay, so that gives me a good sense of your approach. Do you have any stories of striking it lucky or striking out in terms of flirting at Follies?
Striking out? What does that mean?
It means not striking.
Oh, loads, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, my 20s and 30s were littered with nights out where I would just go and then come home on my own and be miserable and just go... what's wrong with me? Why haven't I met anyone that I like? Why does no one like me? Yeah, plenty of times I've cried home on the 86 bus. Of course. Yeah, loads of times.
Were you on the top deck crying or?
Always.
Yeah, that's the best place to cry, I think. This has just like sparked something in my brain and I'd like to just explore it with you. Mm-hmm. When you were that age, when you were younger and you were going out, were you going out on the pull? Like, I am going to score tonight. That's so dangerous,
definitely.
Isn't it?
I know. When I think how much danger I put myself in on a weekly basis, just going out and getting rolling drunk and literally falling over in the street and being blind drunk and then taking complete strangers home with me or going to complete strangers' houses and waking up and no idea where I was. It's insane, isn't it? It's not what you'd want for your children to be doing with their youth, is it really?
It's a way to push your boundaries and understand what you like and what you don't like. But I think the thing of it, like, you know, what you said before about if you don't, I'm trying not to say strike, because I think I confused you before. If you don't get lucky that evening...
I play softball as well, so I should have got the analogy, really, shouldn't I?
If you don't get lucky that evening, then you go home and you, like, make it some kind of personal judgment that you're unlovable and that no one likes you, and then you're just like, I am a worthless human being. Or you put yourself in the situation where you're like, I don't really like you, but I've promised myself I'm going to score tonight, so I'm going to go home with you anyway. And then
I've done that as well. I've been with people, and then my friends come up to me going, Emma, what are you doing? Do you want us to take you out of here and get you out of this situation? Like, no, it's all good, it's all fine. And everything seems like a great idea, like 10 pints in, doesn't it? Yes, I've definitely made some unwise decisions, shall we say.
But you don't learn unless you fail. Well, maybe that's not true. But you learn faster if you fail.
Yeah, I definitely learned lots of lessons. Just very slowly.
So let's go back. I just want to better understand your journey. So you said that you went to... Sorry for using the word journey, by the way, but that's like the best thing I can come up with.
Fair enough.
You said that when you went to university in Liverpool that first day, you were like, I'm not going to tell anyone. And then that all kind of came trembling down, which indicates to me that there was a level of shame around your non-heterosexuality. After coming out and after telling people... No, I think my question actually is, what is your relationship to shame?
That's a good question. It actually feels like it's part of my ancient history because I don't feel that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad I don't feel that anymore. But I think, you know, from my own podcast, Coming Out Stories, I've spoken to so many LGBT people who've all gone through this process, and we've all had to go through some sort of internal struggle before we've approach coming out to ourselves or to our loved ones. And it's almost impossible to avoid. You know, even for people growing up today, there's still that heteronormativity that we are all surrounded by. There's still judgment out there for being gay or bi or trans. There's a lot of judgment out there from the world. So it's really, really difficult to avoid. But I feel like it is something that I went through and I don't feel anymore because now... Actually, being gay is one of the best things that ever happened to me.
And so in terms of the journey, like, it's not just that you come out one day and then the next day you're grand.
No.
But you were going out on the scene, you were exploring that. How did that move and how did that feel? Oh, that sounds like such an airy-fairy question, I'm sorry.
In terms of how did it feel to what? Go out on the scene?
No. I think what I'm trying to get at is there are steps forward, there are steps back, there are tussles, there are bits of shame that you never really overcome, that they're always like buried somewhere deep in your DNA, and then one day they come out and you're like, oh, yeah, why do I still feel that way? Let's examine this. I guess I just want to get a good sense of what that coming out process was like for you.
And I think it's very hard to put your finger on, isn't it? Because it's loads of different coming outs and it's loads of different processes. And even with my parents, it was... Initially, there was acceptance and there was, that's great, we just wanted to be happy, but I really want grandchildren.
Ugh.
But then there was still a period of, oh, but, you know, we might say we're happy, but don't tell the neighbours or don't tell... You know, does this person know? Have you spoken to this person? Do they know? Like, it's some sort of secret, or it should be a secret, or that there was blame proportion to it. So, you know, oh, your dad thinks it's his fault, like, implying that there's something wrong. It's something awful.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas actually it's something, in my opinion, to be celebrated and rejoiced over. So, yeah, it was a slow process to acceptance for everyone that was around me. For sure. So it does take a while, doesn't it? It takes lots and lots of different conversations, even with the same people sometimes, to get to that point where they don't really care either anymore and they're happy to tell their friends.
Yeah, there's that thing as well of being kind of apologetic. So I had a similar experience to what you've just described with your parents, where it was like, we're cool, we don't mind, you are who you are, we love you regardless. Oh, but don't tell this person. Oh, but don't tell this person. Oh, but don't tell this person. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, so do you accept this or you don't accept this? And like, do I go along with what you've told me to do, because that kind of keeps the peace as much as possible. But then I'm the one who's having to suffer, in inverted commas, because I'm having to moderate my behavior. I'm having to overthink every interaction. And then you kind of shrink into yourself. You kind of become this like version of yourself that isn't 100% you. I'm not really sure where I'm going. Where am I going with this?
Yeah, well, I think it is a process, isn't it? And one interesting thing that I can't remember who it was now that said to me about coming out, it's our responsibility as well to educate our parents, you know. And you can't be totally upset or flummoxed by the fact that you may not get the reaction you wanted on day one, because don't forget, you've been thinking about that for a long, long time and internalising it and having lots of conversations with yourself, but it may be the first time they've heard it. And they're not in that world. They're not in our world. They're not part of the community. They're only getting what they're getting from heteronormative society. Mm. So it kind of, it's not just, you know, top down. We have to educate our parents sometimes as well and explain it to them. And that might be a long process for parents to come around, and it might be a long process for them to be 100% as okay with it as you are. So there's lots of conversations that need to be had.
Yeah, I think that's a really good reminder to have that grace and have that patience with your parents. But when you're used to a particular dynamic with them, where they're the ones that are like bringing you into the world and teaching you and helping you to grow, it can feel jarring. It can feel difficult.
Yeah, and it shows that you go for different stages with your parents, don't you, in terms of who has the most knowledge and who has the most power. Like, I remember speaking to one guy whose dad said, well, it's fine because I can take it to the doctor and they've got a cure for that. And like, at that moment, he suddenly realised that his dad didn't know everything and didn't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he knew a lot more than his dad, which is quite a revelation.
Yeah. But if your parents are anything like mine, they'll never admit that.
Yeah. Yes, whether his did, I don't think so. No, parents generally don't, do they?
So not to lose the thread of the conversation, basically it was a journey. There were ups and downs in terms of your coming out and processing it all.
Yeah, it definitely took a while. But I think, I'm sure by the mid-90s, I was just like, yay, this is me. I'm never going to really have a boyfriend again. This is who I am, and you know, made peace with it.
And in that, in coming into yourself, in like fully embracing that side of you, how did Follies help?
I think it's just great to see other gay women, you know, and it's almost like safety in numbers, isn't it, really? You know, when I was that shy teenager at school, 18 years old, and I really thought I was the only lesbian in the world because I didn't know any. Mm. I didn't know any, apart from Martina Navratilova, and I thought I'd never meet her.
But I mean, you also knew your girlfriend who you met on the...
Yeah. Yes, yes. Although she then went and dated as many men as she could because she was worried that everyone would think she was gay, I think. I don't know. Mm. Oh, I've lost my thread now. What was that?
Sorry. I didn't know any lesbians.
Oh, yeah. So that's why places like Follies are so vitally important because, you know, just to go into a gay bar and see loads of other gay women, because in lots of mixed spaces, they're predominantly men, and there are some bars still that we can't go into because they're men only. So to go to a club that is full of other gay women was an absolute revelation to me as a young person. You know, I just felt like I'd arrived. I felt like, wow, there's all this solidarity, there's all this experience, there's all these women who I have got at least one thing in common with. And, you know, we're not, well, we are a minority, but, you know, it's just nice to see yourself reflected back, isn't it? And that's why, you know, gay clubs were so, so important, you know.
Ooh, is that you saying that they're no longer important, or are you just reflecting the fact that they're disappearing?
Well, I was going to ask you this question, actually. Is it dead? I don't know.
I think it's never going to be the same again.
No.
That's what I think. And I think it's really difficult to communicate how vital those spaces were as a lifeline to lots of people. Because now there are digital spaces, there's more visibility, there are other means in which to explore your identity. But for some people, for a very long period of time, these were the only spaces where you could go and just like, breathe.
Yeah. And, you know, I feel partly responsible for killing off gay clubs if they are dying, because certainly the last few times I have dated, I would meet my partners on dating apps and then take them to non-gay bars and go to a different part of town, and I haven't been to Canal Street. Whereas I feel guilty about that. I feel like maybe I should have supported some of the bars in the village.
But and yet, it sounds as though you're saying none of those bars catered to you as a client.
Not particularly.
No. Yeah, so that's tough, isn't it? Because, like, should you go to a place out of loyalty to something that you're not actually going to enjoy?
Yeah.
Probably not.
No, and I certainly wouldn't want that environment for a first date. Anyway, if I'm going with a load of mates and we're having a laugh, maybe, but if you want to have a nice first date, quiet pint, the bar, on a Saturday night on Canal Street, I wouldn't choose that as a first date. That's just my personal preference. And
Of course, that's what we're here to talk about, you.
Well, that's true.
Do you think that spaces like Follies exist anymore?
No. No.
But so what is Manchester missing now that it doesn't have that space for old-fashioned lesbian folklore?
Yeah, I feel like this is what we should start a bar called, old-fashioned lesbian folklore. Yeah, it is missing that sort of big women-only space and a regular night, I think. But I think Follies was a place that was for slightly older lesbians who might want to sit round and meet people and actually talk properly. Whereas I don't think older lesbians go out so much anymore. Mm. Well, I certainly don't, because I've got a baby. And I think that could be part of it. You know, there is that digital space, isn't there? So that maybe people are living in the hills and chatting to other women in real pubs that aren't gay pubs or in digital spaces.
Or just aren't chatting to people.
Yeah. Yeah. Because people don't go to clubs just to sit around chatting and drink cups of tea, do they? They go to just dance to, you know, repetitive beats and lose themselves in the music.
Oh, yes. Your old lesbian's jumping out right now. Okay, so to round us off, I know you said to me that you don't remember the very first time that you ever went to Follies, but let's just, like, suspend our disbelief and pretend that we're going back in time to that first night when you were there at Follies. And let's say, for instance, you had the opportunity to have a conversation with that younger version of yourself who, you know, has come out in university, has kind of grown into herself and her sexuality, but still has some ways to go. What advice would you give her?
Oh, definitely, probably put down the pint and stop drinking yourself into a stupor every time you go out. Because, I mean, this is the problem. I don't remember a lot of my going out and a lot of my experiences and probably half the women I met, you know, and I was probably an absolute idiot. I probably was, so maybe have the odd sober night out, I think, would be my advice, really, and make some better judgments in terms of people that I might be getting home with or people whose hearts I might be breaking or vice versa. You know, I think just calm down a bit. That's probably what I'd say to myself in my 20s. Oh, and probably don't stick around in relationships that are definitely toxic for you. I'd probably add that on as well. So definitely outstayed my welcome in certain relationships where... But you live and learn, don't you? You put up with a lot if you think you're in love with someone, I think. So I probably would say...
Ooh, I want to ask follow-up questions about this. Is that okay?
Yeah.
What do you think keeps you there? Because you think you're in love or because it's something else?
Oh, God, totally, yeah. Totally, totally. You think you're in love and it's... Well, I think I put up with lots of what would be classed as outrageous behaviour because I just thought it was normal and thought that was what being in an adult relationship was going to be like. And I think we just put up with a lot of stuff, don't we, in our youth, until we get the confidence to say, oh, actually, this is not quite right, really. This is not how I should be treated as a human being in an adult relationship.
Mm. But yeah, it's fascinating to me that some people are really good with their boundaries and they're like, oh, this has gone over the line. That's it. Oh, I need to either exit this relationship or
do something.
And then there are people like me, and I'm assuming you based on the information that you've just given me, who was like, oh, yeah, the line, that can just move a bit there. Oh, yeah, we'll just move the line a bit over. Yeah, I'll just accept that. Yeah. I'll just be okay with that. Just having these elastic boundaries and rules that don't serve you at all.
No, exactly. They didn't serve me at all, really. But that's it. You live and learn, don't you? Thankfully.
Yeah.
You make better decisions with the next relationship and with your next partner, and you get better and better at it, which is why I think, well, I settled down at about the age of 48, so that was about right for me. It took me that long to work it out and work out what I needed in a relationship and how I was going to get it.
Ooh.
That sounded like I was totally in control. I wasn't. I just happened to fall in love with the right person this time, probably.
Do you have any memories of follies or clubbing from your own queer scene that you want to share? Well, if you do, I would love to hear all about it, so why not get in touch? I want to create the biggest online record of people's memories and stories of queer clubbing, but I cannot do it alone. I need your help. Go to lostspacespodcast.com, find the section Share a Lost Space, and then tell me all about what you got up to. I would love to hear from you. You can also reach me on Facebook and Instagram, where my handle is Lost Spaces Pod. Find out more about Emma by listening to either one of her podcasts. She has multiples. The first is Coming Out Stories, which is all about coming out stories. It does what it says on the tin. And the second is Effin' Hormones, which is a show all about premenopause. You can also follow her on X or on Twitter or whatever it is you call it, at Emma Goswell. If you liked this episode, I would really appreciate if you took the time to subscribe, leave a review on your podcast platform, or just tell other people who you think might get a kick out of it too. My name is Kay Anderson, and you have been listening to Lost Spaces.